Chapter 8.
"Gentlemen, I did not expect any of you," Mushkin began. "I've been ill today, and I asked Gavril Ardilonovich Ivolgin to deal with your business." He turned to Antip Badovsky. "A month ago, as I informed you at the time. However, I have no objection to a personal explanation, but you must admit that such a time... I suggest you should go with me into another room, if you won't keep me long. My friends are here now, and believe me,
as many friends as you like. But allow us,"
Lebedev's nephew broke in a very reproving tone, though he did not raise his voice,
"allow us to point out that you might have treated us more politely, and not have left us waiting 2 hours in your servants' room.
And, of course, this is behaving like a prince, and this is... I suppose you are the general, but I am not your servant, and I
Antip Badovsky muttered, spluttering with extraordinary excitement, with trembling lips and a voice broken with resentment. He seemed suddenly to burst or explode, but was at once in such a hurry that at the 10th word one could not follow him.
"He was like a prince,"
Ippolit cried in a shrill, cracked voice.
"If I were treated like that," muttered the boxer, "that is, if it were my personal affair as a man of honour, if I were in Badovsky's place, I..."
"Gentlemen, I only heard this minute that you were here. I assure you,"
Mushkin repeated again.
"We're not afraid of your friends, Prince, whoever they may be, for we are within our rights,"
Lebedev's nephew declared again.
"But what right had you? Let me ask."
Ippolit squeaked again, by now extremely excited.
"To submit Badovsky's case to the judgment of your friends. Anyone can see what the judgment of your friends would be."
"But if you don't wish to speak here, Mr. Badovsky,"
Mushkin succeeded in interpolating at last, staggered by such an opening,
"I tell you, let us go into another room at once, and I repeat that I only heard of you all this very minute."
"But you've no right to. You've no right. Your friends. So there..."
Badovsky gabbled suddenly again, looking wildly and apprehensively about him, and the more shy and mistrustful he was, the more heated he became.
"You have no right!"
And having uttered those words, he stopped abruptly, as it were with a sudden snap, and fixing his short-sighted, extremely prominent and bloodshot eyes on Mushkin, he stared at him with dumb inquiry, his whole body bent forward. This time Mushkin was so surprised that he too was speechless, and gazed open-eyed, unable to utter a word.
"Lyov Nikolaevich,"
Lizaveta Prokofievna called to him suddenly,
"read this at once, this minute. It has to do with your business."
She hurriedly held out to him a weekly comic paper, and pointed with her finger at the article. As soon as the visitors came in, Lebedev had skipped sideways up to Lizaveta Prokofievna, with whom he was trying to ingratiate himself, and without uttering a word, he had pulled this paper out of his side pocket and had put it just before her eyes, pointing to a marked passage. What Lizaveta Prokofievna had had time to read had excited and upset her extremely.
"But wouldn't it be better not aloud?" faltered Mushkin, very much embarrassed. "I could read it alone afterwards."
"Then you had better read it. Read it at once, aloud," said Lizaveta Prokofievna, addressing Kolya, impatiently snatching the paper from Mushkin, almost before he had time to touch it. "Read it aloud to all, so that everyone may hear."
Lizaveta Prokofievna was an excitable lady, and readily carried away, so that sometimes she would all of a sudden, without stopping to think, heave all anchors, and launch into the open sea regardless of the weather. Ivan Fyodorovitch moved uneasily. While all involuntarily stopped for the first minute and waited in perplexity, Kolya opened the newspaper and began aloud at the passage which Lebedev darted up to point out to him.
"Proletarians and noble scions. An episode of daily and everyday robbery. Progress, reform, justice. Strange things happen in our so-called holy Russia, in our age of reforms and of joint stock enterprises, the age of national movements and of hundreds of millions of rubles sent abroad every year, the age of encouraging commerce and of the paralysis of industry, and so on and so on. One cannot enumerate all, gentlemen. And so, straight to the point. Here is a strange anecdote about a scion of our decaying nobility, De Profundis, one of those scions whose grandfathers were ruined by roulette, whose fathers have to serve as lieutenants and ensigns in the army, and usually die charged with some innocent misuse of public money, while they themselves, like the hero of our story, either grow up idiots or are mixed up in criminal cases, in which, however, they are acquitted by the jury in the hope of their reformation, or else they end by perpetrating one of those pranks which amaze the public and disgrace our already degraded age. Our scion, wearing gaiters like a foreigner and shivering in an unlined cloak, arrived about 6 months ago in Russia from Switzerland, where he had been under treatment for idiocy. It must be confessed that he was a lucky fellow, so that, to say nothing of the interesting malady for which he was undergoing treatment in Switzerland, can there be a treatment for idiocy? Just imagine. He may serve as an illustration of the truth of the Russian proverb that a certain class of persons are lucky. Only think. Left a baby at his father's death, they say he was a lieutenant who died while on his trial for a sudden disappearance at cards of all the company's money, or possibly for an excessive use of the rod on some subordinate. You remember what it was like in old days, gentlemen? Our baron was taken and brought up by the charity of a very rich Russian landowner. This Russian landowner, we will call him P, was the owner in the old golden days of 4,000 souls. The owner of 4,000 souls. Do you understand, gentlemen, such an expression? I don't. One must consult an explanatory dictionary. The tale is new, yet it's hard to believe. He was apparently one of those drones and sluggards who spend their idle lives abroad, in summer at the waters, and in winter at the Parisian Chateau de Fleur, where in the course of their lives they have left incredible sums. One may say with certainty that at least one-third of the tribute paid in old days by the serfs went into the pockets of the proprietors of the Parisian Chateau de Fleur. He must have been a fortunate man. Be that as it may, the light-hearted P brought up the noble orphan like a prince, engaged tutors and governesses for him, no doubt pretty ones, whom he brought himself, by the way, from Paris. But the last scion of the noble house was an idiot. The governesses from the Chateau de Fleur were of no use, and up to his 20th year, our scion could not be taught to speak any language, not even his native Russian, though the latter, of course, is excusable. At last, the happy whim entered the heart of the Russian serf owner P, that the idiot might be taught sense in Switzerland. A logical whim, however. An idle capitalist might naturally suppose that for money one might buy even sense, especially in Switzerland. 5 years were spent in Switzerland, under the care of a celebrated doctor, and thousands were spent on it. The idiot, of course, did not become sensible, but still, they say, he became like a human being. No great shakes, of course. Suddenly P died, leaving no will, of course. His affairs were, as usual, in disorder. There was a crowd of greedy heirs, who took not the slightest interest in the last scions of noble families who are treated out of charity in Switzerland for congenital idiocy. The scion, though an idiot, made an effort to deceive his doctor, and succeeded in being treated gratis for 2 years, so we are told, concealing from him the death of his benefactor. But the doctor was a bit of a rogue himself. Alarmed at the absence of cash, and still more at the appetite of his 25-year-old do-nothing, he dressed him up in his old gaiters, made him a present of his worn-out cloak, and out of charity sent him third class back to Rusland to get rid of him. Luck seemed to have turned its back on our hero, but not a bit of it. Fortune, which kills off whole provinces with famine, showered all her gifts on this aristocrat, like the cloud in Krylov's fable that passed over the parched fields to empty itself into the ocean. Almost at the very moment of his arrival in Petersburg, a relation of his mother's, who had, of course, been of a merchant's family, died in Moscow, a childless old bachelor, a merchant of the old school and an old believer. He left a good round fortune of several millions in hard cash.
if it had only been for you and me, readers. And it all came without dispute to our scion, our baron, who had been cured of idiocy in Switzerland. Well, it was a very different tune then. A crowd of friends and acquaintances gathered about our gaitered baron, who ran after a notorious beauty of easy virtue. He even picked up relations, and above all, he was pursued by perfect crowds of young ladies, hungering and thirsting for lawful matrimony. And indeed, what could be better? An aristocrat, a millionaire, and an idiot. All the qualifications at once. A husband you couldn't come across the like of if you searched for him with the lantern of Diogenes.
That passes my comprehension, shouted Ivan Fyodorovitch, roused to the last pitch of indignation. Leave off, Kolya, Mushkin cried in a supplicating voice.
Exclamations were uttered on all sides.
Read it! Read it, whatever happens,
Lizaveta Prokofievna rapped out, evidently making a desperate effort to restrain herself.
Prince, if you stop him reading, we shall quarrel.
There was no help for it. Kolya, heated, flushed, and agitated, went on reading in a troubled voice.
But while our quickly made millionaire was floating, so to speak, in the Empyrean, quite a new development came on the scene. One morning a visitor called on him with a composed and stern face, dressed modestly and like a gentleman, and evidently of progressive tendencies. In courteous but dignified reasonable language, he briefly explained the reason of his visit. He was a well-known lawyer. He had been instructed by a young man and was appearing on his behalf. This young man was neither more nor less than the son of the deceased P, though he bore a different name. The licentious P had in his youth seduced a virtuous young girl, a house serf, but of European education, taking advantage, no doubt, of his seigneurial rights in the old serf days, and remarking the inevitable but approaching consequence of the liaison, he made haste to get her married to a man of honourable character, who was engaged in commerce and even in the service, and had long been in love with the girl. At first he helped the young couple, but soon assistance from him was refused, owing to the honourable character of the husband. Some time passed, and P gradually forgot the girl and the son she had borne him, and afterwards, as we know, he died without making provision for him. Meanwhile, his son, who was born in lawful wedlock, but grew up under a different name, and completely adopted by the honourable character of his mother's husband, who had, nonetheless, in the course of time, also died, was thrown entirely on his own resources, with an invalid, bedridden, grieving mother in one of the remote provinces of Russia. He earned his living in the capital by his honourable daily labour, giving lessons in merchant families, and in that way supported himself, first at school, and afterwards while attending courses of profitable lectures, with a view to his future advancement. But one can't earn much by lessons at a few coppers an hour, and with an invalid bedridden mother to keep, though her death at last in the remote province was hardly an alleviation to him. Now the question arises, what would have been a just decision for our noble scion to make? You would doubtless, reader, expect him to say to himself, I have all my life enjoyed all the gifts of P. Tens of thousands went to Switzerland for my education, governesses and treatment for idiocy. And here I am now, with millions, while P's son is wasting his noble talents giving lessons, though he is not to blame for the misconduct of the wanton father who forgot him. All that has been spent on me ought by right to have been spent on him. The vast sums that have been spent on me are, in reality, not mine. It was only the blind mistake of fortune. They ought to have come to the son of P. They ought to have been used for his benefit, and not for mine, as was done by the fantastic caprice of the frivolous and forgetful P. If I were quite noble, delicate, just, I ought to give up to his son half of my fortune. But as I am first of all a prudent person, and know only too well that he has no legal claim, I am not going to give him half my millions. But at any rate, it would be too base and shameless on my part. The scion forgot that it would not be prudent either, if I don't give back now to P's son the tens of thousands that were spent by P on my idiocy. That would only be right and just. For what would have become of me if P had not brought me up and had looked after his son instead of me? But no, that is not how such fine gentlemen look at it. In spite of the representations of the young man's lawyer, who had undertaken his cause solely from friendship, and almost against his will, almost by force, in spite of his pointing out the obligations of honesty, honour, justice, and even of simple prudence, the Swiss patient remained inflexible. And what do you think? All that would have been nothing, but here we come to what was really unpardonable and not to be excused by any illness, however interesting. This millionaire, who had only just cast off the gaiters of his professor, could not even discern that this noble character, who was wearing himself out giving lessons, was not asking for charity, was not asking for assistance, but for his right and his due, even though he has no legal claim. He does not ask for it even, but his friends demand it on his account. With a majestic air, revelling in the power of using his millions to crush people with impunity, our scion pulls out a 50-ruble note and sends it to the noble young man by way of insulting charity. You refuse to believe it? You are disgusted, you are pained, you utter exclamations of indignation. But that was what he did. The money was, of course, returned to him at once, so to speak, flung back in his face. What resource have we left us? There is no legal claim, there is no resource but publicity. We present the story to the public, guaranteeing its authenticity. One of our well-known humorous writers has perpetrated a charming epigram on the subject, which deserves to take a place not only in provincial sketches of Russian life, but even in the capital. Dear little Lyov, for 5 long years, wrapped warm in Schneider's cloak, lived like a child and often played some simple foolish joke. Then home he came in gaiters tight, and found himself an heir, and gaily he the students robbed, the idiot millionaire.
When Kolya had finished reading, he handed the paper to Mushkin, and without saying a word, rushed away, buried himself in a corner, and hid his face in his hands. He felt insufferably ashamed, and his boyish sensitiveness, unaccustomed to such nastiness, was wounded beyond endurance. It seemed to him as though something extraordinary had happened, which had shattered everything, and that he was almost the cause of it, by the very fact of having read it aloud. But everyone seemed to be feeling something of the same sort. The girls felt very awkward and ashamed. Lizaveta Prokofievna was struggling with violent anger. She too, perhaps, was bitterly regretting that she had meddled. Now she was silent. Mushkin felt, as oversensitive people often do in such cases, he was so much ashamed of the conduct of others, he felt such shame for his visitors, that for the first moment he was ashamed to look at them. Titsin, Varya, Ganya, even Lebediev, all had rather an embarrassed air. The strangest thing was that Ippolit and the son of Pavlishchov both seemed surprised. Lebediev's nephew, too, was obviously displeased. The boxer was the only one who sat quite serene, twisting his moustache with a dignified air and eyes cast down, not from embarrassment, but apparently from modest pride and unmistakable triumph. It was clear that he was delighted with the article.
"This is beyond anything," General Epanchin muttered in an undertone, "as though 50 lackeys had met together and composed it."
"Allow me to ask you, my dear sir, how dare you make such insulting suppositions?"
cried Ippolit, trembling all over.
"This for an honourable man, you must admit yourself, General, that if it's an honourable man, it's insulting," muttered the boxer, who also seemed suddenly roused, twisting his moustache and twitching his shoulders and body.
"In the first place, I am not your dear sir, and in the second place, I have no intention of giving you any explanation."
Ivan Fyodorovitch answered harshly. He was awfully annoyed. He got up from his seat and, without saying a word, went to the entrance of the veranda and stood on the top step with his back to the party, in violent indignation with his wife, who even now did not think fit to move.
"'Friends, allow me to speak at last,'
Mushkin exclaimed in distress and agitation.
"'And I beg you, let us talk so that we may understand one another. "'I say nothing about the article, gentlemen. Let it alone. "'Only one thing, friends. It's all untrue, what is said in the article. "'I say so because you know that yourselves. "'It's shameful, in fact, so that I should be greatly surprised "'if any one of you has written it.'
"'I knew nothing about the article to this moment,'
Hippolyt announced.
"'I don't approve of the article.
"'Though I knew it was written, I too wouldn't have advised its being published "'because it's premature,'
added Lebediev's nephew.
"'I knew, but I have the right. I
muttered the son of Pavlishchov.
"'What? Did you make all that up yourself?'
asked Mushkin, looking with curiosity at Badovsky.
"'But it's impossible.' "'We may refuse to recognise your right to ask such questions,'
Lebediev's nephew put in.
"'I only wondered that Mr. Badovsky could bring himself. "'But I mean to say, since you have given publicity to the case, "'why were you so offended just now at my talking about it before my friends?'
"'At last,'
muttered Lizaveta Prokofievna indignantly.
"'And, Prince, you are pleased even to forget,'
Lebediev, unable to restrain himself, threaded his way between the chairs almost in a fever.
"'You are pleased to forget that it was only through your kindness and the infinite goodness of your heart you received them and listened to them, and that they have no right to demand anything, especially as you have already put the matter into the hands of Gavriil Ardalionovitch, and that, too, you did through your excessive kindness. And now, most illustrious Prince,' "'In the midst of your chosen friends, "'you cannot sacrifice such a company to these gentlemen, "'and you might, so to speak, "'turn all these gentlemen out at once into the street, "'and I, as master of the house, "'would with the greatest pleasure—' "'Perfectly right!'
"'General Ivolgin thundered suddenly from the back of the room.
"'Enough, Lebediev, enough, enough!'
"'Mushkin was beginning, "'but his words were lost in a perfect explosion of indignation.
"'No!' "'Excuse me, Prince, excuse me, that's not enough now,'
bawled Lebediev's nephew, shouting above everyone else.
"'Now we must put the case on a firm and clear basis, for it is evidently not understood. "'There is some legal quibble involved, and on account of that quibble they threaten to turn us into the street. "'But is it possible, Prince, you can think of such fools as not to understand that we have no legal claim whatever?' "'And that if the case is analysed from a legal point of view, "'we have no right to ask for a single rouble. "'But we thoroughly grasp that. "'Though there is no legal claim, "'there is a human, natural claim, "'the claim of common sense and the voice of conscience. "'And though that claim may not be written in any rotten human code, "'yet a generous and honest man, "'in other words, a man of common sense, "'is bound to remain generous and honest "'even on points that are not written in the codes.' "'That's why we've come here without any fear of being turned out into the street, "'as you threatened just now, because we don't beg, but demand. "'And because of the impropriety of our visit at such a late hour, "'though we didn't come at a late hour, but you kept us waiting in the servants' room, "'we came, I say, without fear, because we assumed you to be a man of common sense, "'that is, of honour and conscience. "'Yes, it's true, we came in not humbly.' "'Not as beggars or cadgers, but with our heads erect, like free men. "'Not a bit with a petition, but with a free and proud request. "'You hear? Not with a petition, but with a request. "'Take that in. We put the question to you directly and with dignity. "'Do you consider yourself right or wrong in Berdovsky's case? "'Do you admit that you were benefited and perhaps saved from death by Pavlishchov?' "'If you admit it, and it's evident, do you, after receiving millions, "'intend or think it just to compensate Pavlishchov's son in his poverty, "'even though he does spare the name of Badovsky? "'Yes or no? "'If yes, that is, in other words, if you have what you call in your language "'honour and conscience, and what we more exactly describe by the term common sense, "'then satisfy us, and the matter is finished.' "'Satisfy us without entreaties or gratitude on our part. "'Don't expect them of us. "'For you are doing it not for our sake,
but for the sake of justice. If you are unwilling to satisfy us, that is answer no, we go away at once and the case is over, and we tell you to your face before all your witnesses that you are a man of coarse intelligence and low development, that for the future you dare not call yourself a man of honour and conscience, and have no right to do so, that you are trying to buy that right too cheap. I've finished. I've put the question. Turn us into the street now, if you dare. You can do it. You have the power. But remember all the same that we demand and we don't beg. We demand. We do not beg.
Lebediev's nephew stopped, much excited.
We demand! We demand! We demand! We don't beg!
Bodovsky gabbled thickly and turned red as a crab. After the speech made by Lebediev's nephew, there was a general movement and even a murmur of protest, though everyone in the party was evidently anxious to avoid meddling, except perhaps Lebediev, who seemed in a perfect fever. Strange to say, Lebediev, though evidently on Mushkin's side, seemed to feel a glow of family pride at the speech of his nephew. Anyway, he looked at the company present with a certain peculiar air of satisfaction.
In my opinion, Mushkin began in rather a low voice. In my opinion, Mr. Doktorenko, in half of what you said just now you are quite right, and in the greater half, in fact. And I should agree with you entirely, if you hadn't left something out in your speech. I can't tell you what you've left out exactly. I'm not capable. But to make your speech quite just, something more is wanted. But we had better turn to the case, gentlemen. Tell me, what made you publish that article? There isn't a word in it that isn't slander. So that to my thinking, gentlemen, you've done something mean.
Excuse me,
my dear sir,
this
was heard at the same time from the excited visitors.
As for the article,
Ippolit put in shrilly.
As for that article, I have told you already that I and the rest don't approve of it. It was written by him here.
He pointed to the boxer, who was sitting beside him.
It's written disgracefully, I admit. It's written illiterately, and in the jargon used by retired army men like him. He is stupid, and besides that, he is a mercenary fellow, I agree. I tell him so to his face every day, but yet in half of it he was right. Publicity is the legal right of all, and therefore of Bodovsky. He must answer himself for his absurdities. As for my protesting in the name of all against the presence of your friends, I think it necessary to inform you, gentlemen, that I protested simply to assert our rights. But in reality, we positively prefer that there should be witnesses. And on our way here, we all four agreed that whoever your witnesses might be, if even they were your friends, they could not fail to recognize Bodovsky's claim, because it's a mathematical certainty, so that it's even better that these witnesses are your friends. It will make the truth even more evident.
That's true. We agreed about that,
Lebediev's nephew assented.
But why did you begin by making such a fuss and outcry about it, if you wanted it? Asked Mushkin in surprise.
And as for the article, Prince,
put in the boxer, becoming agreeably excited and desperately anxious to put in his word. It might be suspected that the presence of the ladies had a strong and unmistakable effect on him.
As for the article, I confess that I am the author of it. Though my sick friend, whom I am accustomed to excuse on account of his affliction, has just criticised it. But I wrote and I published it in the journal of a friend in the form of a letter. Only the verses are not mine, and really come from the pen of a well-known satirist. I only read it through to Mr. Bodovsky, and not all of it, and he at once agreed to let me publish it. But you can see for yourself that I could have published it without his consent. The right to publicity is the right of all. And it's an honourable and beneficial right. I hope you, Prince, are progressive enough not to deny that.
I'm not going to deny anything.
But you must admit that your article is severe, you mean. But you know it's for the public benefit, so to say. And besides, how can one let such a flagrant case pass? So much the worse for the guilty, but the public benefit before everything. As for a little inaccuracy, hyperbole, so to say, you will admit that what matters most is the motive. The object, the intention comes first. What matters is the beneficial example, and one can go into the individual case afterwards. And besides, There's the style and the comic value of it. And in fact, everybody writes like that, as you know yourself.
But you are quite on a false track, I assure you, gentlemen, cried Mushkin. You published that article on the supposition that nothing would induce me to satisfy Mr. Berdovsky, and so you try to frighten me and revenge yourselves. But how do you know? I may have decided to satisfy Mr. Berdovsky's claim. I tell you plainly before everyone here that I will.
Well, come, that's a wise and generous saying from a wise and very generous man, announced the boxer.
Heavens! Broke in Lizaveta Prokofievna.
Oh, this is insufferable, muttered the general.
Allow me, friends, allow me. I'll explain the case, Mushkin besought them. Your agent and representative, Chuborov, came to see me 5 weeks ago, Mr. Berdovsky. Your description of him, Mr. Keller, is much too flattering, Mushkin added, addressing the boxer and suddenly laughing. I didn't like him at all. I realized in the first moment that this Chuborov was at the bottom of it, and that, to speak candidly, he had taken advantage of your simplicity, Mr. Berdovsky, to set you on to making this claim.
You've no right to... I'm not simple, is it?
Berdovsky stuttered in excitement.
You've no sort of right to make such suppositions,
Lebedev's nephew put in sententiously.
This is insulting in the highest degree, squeaked Ippolit. The supposition is insulting, false, and irrelevant.
I'm sorry, gentlemen. I'm sorry, Mushkin apologized hurriedly. Please excuse me. It's because I thought it might be better for us to be perfectly open with one another. But it's for you to decide as you please. I told Chuborov that, as I was not in Petersburg, I would at once authorize a friend to go into the case, and would let you, Mr. Berdovsky, know. I tell you plainly, gentlemen, that the case struck me as simply a swindle, just because of Chuborov's share in it.
"Oh, don't take offence, gentlemen. For goodness sake, don't take offence!"
Mushkin cried in alarm, seeing again the signs of resentment in Berdovsky and of excitement and protest in his friends.
"It can have no reference to you if I do say the case was a swindle. I didn't know any one of you personally then. I didn't even know your names. I only judged by Chuborov. I speak generally because if only you knew how horribly I've been taken in since I came into my fortune.
Prince!" You are wonderfully naive,
Lebedev's nephew observed ironically.
Besides, you are a prince and a millionaire. You may possibly be kind-hearted and simple, but even if you are, you can't be an exception to the general law,
Ippolit declared. Possibly, gentlemen. Very possibly, Mushkin said hurriedly. Though I don't know what general law you are speaking of. But let me go on and don't take offence about nothing. I swear I haven't the faintest wish to insult you. And really, gentlemen, one can't say one word sincerely without your being offended at once. But in the first place, it was a great shock to hear of the existence of a son of Pavlishchov, and in such a terrible situation, as Chuborov explained to me. Pavlishchov was my benefactor and my father's friend. Ugh, why did you write such falsehoods about my father in your article, Mr. Keller? There never was any misappropriation of the company's money, nor ill-treatment of subordinates. Of that I am absolutely convinced. And how could you lift your hand to write such a calumny? And what you've said about Pavlishchov is past all endurance. You speak of that noble man as a frivolous libertine, with as much boldness and positiveness as though you were really speaking the truth, and yet he was one of the most virtuous men in the world. He was a remarkably learned man. He used to correspond with numbers of distinguished men of science, and he spent a great deal of money for the advancement of science. As for his heart and his benevolence... Oh, no doubt you were quite right in saying that I was almost an idiot at that time, and had no understanding of anything, though I could talk Russian and could understand it. But I can now appreciate all I remember at its true value.
Excuse me,
Ippolit squeaked.
Isn't this too sentimental? We are not children. You mean to come straight to the point? It's going on for 10, remember that?
Very well, gentlemen, Mushkin agreed at once. After my first mistrustfulness, I decided that I might have made a mistake, and that Pavlishchov might really have had a son. But I was very much amazed that that son should so readily, that is, I mean so publicly, give away the secret of his birth and disgrace his mother's name. For even at that time, Chuborov threatened me with publicity.
How ridiculous! Cried Lebedev's nephew.
You've no right! You've no right! Cried Berdovsky.
The son is not responsible for the immoral conduct of his father, and the mother is not to blame,
Ippolit shrieked hotly.
"'All the more reason for sparing her, I should have thought,' Mushkin ventured timidly.
"'You're not simply naive, Prince. You go beyond that, perhaps,'
Lebedev's nephew sneered spitefully.
"'And what right had you?'
Ippolit squeaked in a most unnatural voice. "'None whatever. None whatever,' Mushkin hurriedly put in. "'You are right there, I admit it. But I couldn't help it. And I said to myself at once, at the time, that I ought not to let my personal feeling come into the case.' For if I consider myself bound to satisfy Mr. Berdovsky's demands for the sake of my feeling for Pavlishchov, I ought to satisfy them in any case. That is, whether I respected or did not respect Mr. Berdovsky. I only began about this gentleman because it did all the same seem to me unnatural for a son to betray his mother's secret so publicly. In fact, it was chiefly on that ground that I made up my mind that Cherbarov was a scoundrel— and had egged Mr. Berdovsky on to such a fraud by deceit.
"'But this is intolerable!'
broke from his visitors, some of whom even leapt up from their seats. "'Gentlemen, it was just because of that I decided that poor Mr. Berdovsky must be a simple and helpless person, easily imposed upon by swindlers, and therefore I was all the more bound to help him as a son of Pavlishchov, first by opposing Mr. Cherbarov, secondly by my friendly good offices and guidance, and thirdly— I decided to give him 10,000 roubles. That is all that, by my reckoning, Pavlishchov could have spent upon me.
What? Only 10,000?
Shouted Ippolit.
Well, Prince, you're not at all good in arithmetic, or else you are too good at it, though you do pretend to be a simpleton, cried Lebedev's nephew.
I won't agree to take 10,000, said Berdovsky.
And to take it.
The boxer prompted him in a clear and rapid whisper, bending across to him over the back of Ippolit's chair.
Take it, and afterwards we shall see.
Listen, Mr. Mishkin, shrieked Ippolit. Understand that we are not fools, not vulgar fools, as we are probably thought to be by all your visitors, and by these ladies who sneer at us so indignantly, and especially by that grand gentleman.
He pointed to Yevgeny Pavlovich.
"'Whom I have not, of course, the honour of knowing, though I believe I have heard something about him.'
"'Allow me, gentlemen. You misunderstand me again,' Mushkin addressed them in agitation. "'In the first place, you, Mr. Keller, in your article have described my fortune very inaccurately. I didn't inherit millions at all. I've only perhaps an eighth or a tenth part of what you suppose. And in the next place, tens of thousands were not spent on me in Switzerland.' Schneider was paid 600 roubles a year, and he only received that for the first 3 years. And Pavlishchov never went to Paris to find pretty governesses. That's a calumny again. In my opinion, very much less than 10,000 was spent on me altogether. But I propose to give 10,000, and you'll admit that I could not offer Mr. Berdovsky more in payment of what's due to him, even if I were awfully fond of him. And I could not do so from a feeling of delicacy alone— just because it's paying what is due and not making him a present. I don't know how you can fail to understand that, gentlemen, but still I did mean later on, by my friendship and active sympathy, to compensate the unhappy Mr. Berdovsky, who has evidently been deceived, for he could not otherwise have agreed to anything so low as, for instance, publishing this scandal about his mother in Mr. Keller's article. But why are you getting angry again, gentlemen? We shall completely misunderstand each other. Why, it's turned out to be as I thought. I am convinced now by what I see myself that my guess was correct. Mushkin tried eagerly to persuade them, anxious to pacify their excitement, and not noticing that he was only increasing it.
Convinced now of what?
They fell upon him almost in a fury. Why, in the first place, I've had time to see clearly what Mr. Berdovsky is myself. I see now, myself, what he is. He is an innocent man, taken in by everyone. A helpless man. And therefore I ought to spare him. And in the second place, Gavril Ardilionovitch, to whom the case has been entrusted and from whom I heard nothing for a long time, because I was travelling, and afterwards was for 3 days ill in Petersburg, has just now, an hour ago, at our first interview, told me that he has seen through Cherbarov's schemes, that he has proofs, and that Cherbarov is just what I took him to be. I know, gentlemen, that many people look upon me as an idiot, and, owing to my reputation for giving away money freely, Cherbarov thought that he could easily impose upon me, and he reckoned just on my feeling for Pavlishchov. But the chief point is—now hear me out, gentlemen, hear me out—the chief point is that it appears now that Mr. Berdovsky is not a son of Pavlishchov at all.' "'Gavriil R. de Leonovich has just told me, "'and he assures me that he has positive proof of it. "'Well, what do you think of that? "'One can scarcely believe it, after all the to-do that has been made. "'And listen, there are positive proofs. "'I can't believe it yet. "'I don't believe it myself. "'I assure you I am still doubting, "'because Gavriil R. de Leonovich has not had time to give me all the details yet. "'But that Cherbarov is a scoundrel, there can be no doubt at all now.' "'He has imposed upon poor Mr. Badovsky, and on all of you gentlemen, "'who have so nobly come to support your friend, "'for he obviously needs support, I understand that, of course. "'He has imposed upon all of you, "'and has involved you all in a fraudulent business. "'For you know it really is fraud. "'It's swindling. "'How swindling?'
"'Not the son of Pavlishov. "'How is it possible?'
"'Exclamations were heard on all sides. "'All Badovsky's party were in inexpressible perturbation.' "'Yes, of course it's swindling. "'For if Mr. Badovsky turns out not to be the son of Pavlishov, "'his claim is simply fraudulent. "'That is, of course, if he knew the truth. "'But the fact is he has been deceived. "'That's why I insist on his characters being cleared. "'That's why I say that he deserves to be pitied for his simplicity "'and can't be left without help. "'If it were not so, he would be a scoundrel too. "'But I am convinced that he did not understand.' I was just in the same state before I went to Switzerland. I, too, used to mutter incoherently. One tries to express oneself and can't. Understand that I can sympathize very well, because I am almost the same, so I may be allowed to speak of it. And all the same, although there is no son of Pavlishov, and it all turns out to be humbug, I haven't changed my mind, and am ready to give up 10,000 in memory of Pavlishov. Before Mr. Badovsky came on the scene, I meant to devote 10,000 to founding a school in memory of Pavlishov. But it makes no difference now whether it's for a school or for Mr. Badovsky. For though Mr. Badovsky is not the son of Pavlishov, he is almost as good as a son of his, because he has been so wickedly deceived. He genuinely believed himself to be the son of Pavlishov. Listen to Gavriil Ardilonovich, friends. Let us make an end of this. Don't be angry. Don't be excited. Sit down. Gavriil Ardilonovich will explain everything to us directly, and I confess I shall be very glad to hear all the details myself. He says he has even been to Pskov to see your mother, Mr. Badovsky, who hasn't died at all, as they've made you say in the article. Sit down, gentlemen. Sit down.
Mushkin sat down and succeeded in making Badovsky and his friends, who had leapt up from their seats, sit down again. For the last 10 or 20 minutes he had been talking eagerly and loudly, with impatient haste, carried away and trying to talk above the rest, and he couldn't, of course, help bitterly regretting afterwards some assumptions and some phrases that escaped him now. If he hadn't himself been worked up and roused almost beyond control, he would not have allowed himself so boldly and hurriedly to utter aloud certain conjectures and unnecessarily candid statements. He had no sooner sat down in his place than a burning remorse set his heart aching. Besides the fact that he had insulted Badovsky by so publicly assuming that he had suffered from the same disease for which he himself had been treated in Switzerland, the offer of the 10,000 that had been destined for a school had been made, to his thinking, coarsely and carelessly, like a charity, and just because it had been spoken of aloud before people. "'I ought to have waited and offered it to him tomorrow, alone,' Mushkin thought at once. "'Now perhaps there will be no setting it right. "'Oh, yes, I am an idiot. "'A real idiot,' he decided, in a paroxysm of shame and extreme distress. "'Meanwhile, Gavriil Ardilionovich, who had hitherto stood on one side persistently silent, "'came forward at Mushkin's invitation, took up his stand beside him, "'and began calmly and clearly giving an account of the case "'that had been entrusted to him by the prince. "'All talk was instantly silenced. "'Everyone listened with extreme curiosity, "'especially Badovsky's party.'